That's the title of my talk, Probing Reionization with CMB Polarization. CMB polarization, by that I mean the large angle CMB polarization. So on scales, angular scales of like, 10 degrees. The summary, so you can see where we're going, is basically that map should be able to detect this reionization feature in the CMB polarization. Probably with 4 years of data. Maybe they'll say something in Jan. The one sigma for the tau is the optical depth for Thomson scattering all the way out to the last scattering surface is around 5%. This actually depends upon, what you assume you know about the reionization history and things like that. The canonical number before that Wayne Hu and collaborators had calculated was like 0.03 or 0.02. But that can actually change, as I said, depending upon what you think you know about reionization.
This is the probability that a photon from recombination scatters on its way to us?
No. It's basically number density of electrons multiplied by Thomson scattering integrated along the line of sight. So e to the minus tau.
That's what I said.
Well, e to the minus tau is actually the probability.
So it's more or less.
Yeah.
It's the
log of
every recombination.
It's minus log of that probability. So if if sigma was like large, then e to the minus tau, you wouldn't get anything. But the surprising thing here is that that there's more information in the CMB polarization than just this optical depth, and I'll come back to it in just a moment. And that Planck can actually differentiate between two models with the same optical depth, but different reionization histories. And the last point is sort of more relevant to cosmology, which is that this large angle CMB polarization is really vital if you want to pin down the amplitude of primordial fluctuations. What the CMB temperature fluctuations measure really well is the amplitude of the fluctuations multiplied by e to the minus 2 tau. Okay, so right now that quantity is pinned down to like 10%. With after MAP, or let's say after Planck, it'll be like it'll be pinned down to a fraction of a percent. But what that means is you know the amplitude times e to the minus 2 tau, so you know the amplitude only as well as you know tau. Right, so it's really important to measure that, because that really pins down the primordial fluctuations at high redshift, and then it's important for example CMB lensing or weak lensing, and all these things actually depend upon. So in years, since I'm not an expert in this reionization field, I thought I would put down a few numbers here, so those of you who don't know about it can actually get a feeling. E nuke is basically the energy released from nuclear synthesis and in stars, and that's the binding energy divided by 4 nucleons multiplied by the number density of baryons times the fraction of baryons that are in stars. So that's sort of roughly the amount of energy that you release. And the fraction of this energy that actually ionizes is, that fraction with energy greater than 13.6 EVs. If I assume that the typical ionizing photon has an energy of 13.6 EV, then, this divided by 13.6 should be approximately the number density of hydrogen atoms if you have to, ionize them at least once. And if you just plug in the numbers, it turns out that, the fraction of baryons that should be in stars is pretty tiny. So it's easy to ionize the universe, except you've got to keep it ionized, right? Because every time you ionize the hydrogen atom, there's a finite probability that it's going to recombine. And the recombination rate divided by the expansion rate scales like this. So roughly at Z of 10, the recombination rate and the expansion rate are the same. So, if you're above Z of 10 and you want to ionize something, you got to make sure that you don't just ionize it once, but you need to keep ionizing it. I mean, offset this recombination rate. So, and also just to orient yourself, a 100 solar mass star is sort of like a 10 to the 5 Kelvin black body, roughly. Anyway, just one more slide on ionizing sources. So as I said, these could be stars or quasars, and the requirements are that you ionize it and then keep it ionized. And this ionizing photon production rate depends upon a lot of dirty stuff. Things like the rate at which the gas is converted into ionizing sources, what's the initial mass function of this ionizing source population, right? If it's like stars, you know, what's the typical mass of a star, the initial stars? And then the photon production rate per source. And then you got to worry, and this is something which is really uncertain, the fraction of photons actually escaping into the intergalactic medium. You know, and how clumped is the intergalactic medium. So anyway, these are sort of the things that actually go in when people do semi-analytic calculations. And this is from a semi-analytic calculation by Zoltan Hyman, actually. For reasonable numbers of, you know, these things, it turns out that it's hard to ionize the universe much. This is probably more like 30. It's hard to ionize the universe much before Z of 30. And that's like, you know, tau max of 0.2, 0.3. And that's sort of common sense, right? I mean, you don't have too much structure before Z of 30, so. Anyway, so what's the motivation for doing this? One big thing which is not on this slide is obviously that you want to get the, you know, the higher redshift. You want to get the prime amplitude of the primordial fluctuations. But as far as astrophysics is concerned, what do you want to do? It's you want to probe the dark ages because you really don't have any information about what's beyond Z of 6. Right? You know a lot at Z of 1100, but between 6 and 1100, you don't know that much. You know, for example, is there what actually you know did this reionization? Is it the X-ray background? X-rays actually can produce, you know, hot electrons, and then that can actually ionize. How did this neutral to ionized transition take place? Was it sudden, or, you know, did it happen gradually? And if you think about this quasar absorption line things, you know, that actually the Gunn-Peterson trough, there's something a little troubling about it, right? Because you just probe one line of sight and then you extrapolate that to the entire universe. So it's great to have something else which will actually also tell you about this transition. And this Gunn-Peterson trough method, it's actually very hard to push it to higher redshifts simply because of the large opacities. I mean, you can integrate for like, you know, a year, but nobody's going to give you that much telescope time. So in general, you know, it's basically you want to know about the first objects to form. And this is not the only method out there. There's other ways to do it. You can actually look at metal line absorptions, in particular the oxygen, because the oxygen line. And then you can look at small scale anisotropies in the CMB. You can look at the 21 centimeter Gunn-Peterson trough. And this was like talked about long back by Rees and Hogan. And you can also look at the profiles of these Lyman alpha emission lines. And so there's a bunch of other methods, except all these, you know, involve a lot of assumptions. For example, this metal line, you know, it's a pretty cute idea, but you need to have a lot of metals around at Z greater than 6.3, and you need to be observing GRBs and like infrared and things like that. So there's a lot of assumptions built in, and I really think that this large angle CMB is the cleanest probe of all of this. Okay, so what's the signal of reionization in the CMB? It's actually pretty simple. You have an intrinsic quadrupole, temperature quadrupole, that's at reionization. So this is coming from, you know, the acoustic oscillations at last scattering surface. Well, actually, it's not oscillations, but this is basically just the Sachs-Wolfe effect, right? The temperature fluctuations on the very largest scales. And that quadrupole actually produces this polarization feature. So the way to think about reionization is if you have a quadrupole temperature and isotropy, you end up getting a polarization signal because the Thomson scattering cross section goes as cos square theta, so it actually couples to the quadrupole. And actually, this is so simple. I mean, it looks like a lot of junk here, but it the physics is so simple that it only depends upon this optical depth tau, the amplitude of the primordial fluctuations, and n, which is the index of the primordial fluctuations. And so it's essentially just these three parameters, and you can actually write this down analytically, the CMB fluctuations in the polarization at large angle. So I told you that, from the temperature fluctuations, you get A times e to the minus 2 tau, and here you get another combination. And that's how you break this degeneracy.
So that formula is a reprocessing primordial
CLs? Actually, it's not even reprocessing because there's actually no polarization signal, almost no polarization signal at large angles from the primordial stuff. This is all on like much smaller scales. And here you're looking at, this is only valid on scales L less than 30. So. No, you get the quadrupole from the last scattering surface.
You have the quadrupole. You already have polarization.
Right, you already have the quadrupole. I mean, So the quadrupole in the temperature actually produces a polarization signal. Right. So if you have temperatures, if there's hot and there's cold here, and they're separated by 90 degrees, and you have a photon coming in here and scattering off an electron, you can actually just show that it actually intrinsically produces a linear polarization. And so the only prerequisite is that you already have an existing quadrupole, right? And that exists because, I mean, there's temperature fluctuations of the order of 10 to the minus 5 on all scales. Just coming from inflation, so.
And the effect of the tau from the ionization is to somewhat smear out the polarization.
Right. I mean, if tau is, so it's basically tells you what fraction of light you actually receive. Yeah. So that's important. Yeah. The role of ionization is basically to give you free electrons. There were free electrons at the last scattering surface. Then the universe was neutral, or almost neutral, for a very, very long time. And then this reionization happened, and then you had free electrons again. And so the photons could interact with them and
any
produce.
Any rescattering tends to kill the polarization.
Any rescattering?
Tends to kill the polarization.
Tends to. I mean, you wouldn't have the polarization if it was not for the scattering. The scattering itself.
But the rescattering later due to.
Self-polarization
only
if there's a quadrupole. So if you didn't have a quadrupole, the net polarization
would be zero.
Exactly.
If you have a quadrupole, then if you do scatter, then you will observe the net polarization.
So the reionized photons induce a polarization or wipe out a previous one? No.
Reionized electrons
induce.
Existing polarization.
There is no existing polarization on these scales.
You're saying opposite.
No.
First I get a polarized photon from recombination.
Yeah, but
it's traveling a few many z's.
Yeah, yeah,
and
but
then it gets rescattered due to this, right?
Yeah,
and
but
it just tends to wash out a little bit.
Yeah, but the thing is, Leo, the polarization that you get from the last scattering surface, those correlations are on really small scales. They're on the scales of basically the sound horizon at last scattering, which is, let's say 100 megaparsec. So if you look at correlations in the polarization on 1,000 megaparsec scale, without this reionization, there would be none.
It washes out the small scale stuff and turns it into large scale polarizations.
So you need the ionized electrons
right
to repolarize.
What?
Right? That's what you're saying.
I mean, on large scales, you don't have the polarization.
Exactly. I mean,
that's what I'm saying.
It's almost.
Large scale, so it's
So this first quantum pole is a local quantum pole. It's not the code.
No, it's the intrinsic quadrupole. Well, yeah, so if I had no reionization and I plotted...
How can reionization create polarization?
The same reason why the last scattering surface creates polarization. Reionization is just a presence of free electrons.
You need the free electrons to scatter and to be polarized. The polarization.
It's the same thing as the last scattering surface, except the correlations are produced in... So this is what the last scattering surface would do.
It's still induced by the quadrupole of the temperature.
Yes, exactly. So the reionization would actually end up producing a bump here, where the signal is almost negligible coming from the last scattering.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. It's all on the horizon size. So the horizon size is like... Right, so this is the typical multipole, which is around L equals 10, where you actually produce the polarization. And dA is just the angular diameter distance. ZRI is essentially the redshift at which reionization takes place. So it's the angular diameter distance to the surface of reionization divided by, the horizon at reionization. So it's of the order of 10, because dA is of the order of 10,000 megaparsecs. This is of the order of 1,000 megaparsecs. So you produce these things on scales of L equals 10. Actually from CMB first. It's actually the evolution of the number density of electrons divided by the number density of the total number of protons in here. So there's last scattering. The number density of electron has dropped sharply. It's around 10 to the minus, whatever it is here. It's just a little about 10 to the minus 4. Nothing much happens except when you reach around Z of 15, wherein I have put in by hand that the universe get partially reionized, and it does so really fast. Then it stays constant for a long time, and this is Z of 6.3, where the universe gets fully ionized. So it's important to keep in mind that this Gunn-Peterson trough is really telling you that there's something dramatic going on at Z of 6.3, but we don't know if that dramatic thing is is Xe going from 0 to 1, or like 80% to 100%. Both of them are equally dramatic. So that's something that the Gunn-Peterson trough won't tell you. And obviously what I've drawn here is actually a very idealized case. Right? I mean, you could have something like this, or even something which goes up to 1, comes back down, and then goes back again.
So what is the picture here? The second step is stars turning on?
So the first step is, let's say, stars, like pop 3 stars or something like that. It ionizes the universe to like 20% of the electrons are, the hydrogen atoms are ionized. And then it stays like that for a long time. This is typically hard to do. It would have gone down a little bit and then come back up or something like that. But anyway, you can make models like this. And then out here, it's another population of stars. Which
is
turn on.
Two steps that are important for you, the model?
No, I'm just trying to illustrate, what kind of differences you can actually see in the CMB. So, qualitatively, the results will be the same, regardless of what sort of curve you put in. So here's the sort of differences that you get in the CMB. I plotted L square CL, just keep in mind that I've taken away the L squares. That's why all this stuff is much lower. And the error bars here are just cosmic variance. I forgot what it is. But one, both these curves, the dotted and the dashed, have the same optical depth of around 10%.
Why did you move it up?
Yeah, well, I can read it. I don't think you need to read it.
Is
it a secret?
No. okay, so one of them has, one of them got reionized initially at Z of 30, and the other one was at Z of 15, okay. So you can clearly tell the difference between them. And most of the power is coming from actually between L of tel and 30. And you can tell the difference between them if, for example, you're able to like, you know, control your foregrounds and you have an experiment like Planck. I mean, this is not going to be doable with MAP.
But could you disentangle that with the uncertainty of the power index, of the spectral index?
Yeah, so it... Yeah, so that's a good question because you want to make sure that the other parameters, like the power and the spectral index, which is the other parameter, doesn't actually create a bigger sort of error bars on this, and it doesn't, because Planck will actually get the spectral index to say, you know, 0.005 or something like that. What it actually means is that this cosmic variance error bar is sort of larger than any other error bar you can think of. So, yeah, you need to bother about it. And there's also information in this RL, which is just actually the correlation between the E and the T normalized. So,
are they anti-correlated at RL? Is that what that, or was it just dropping to be uncorrelated?
No, they're actually anti-correlated at large L, and I don't know why right now. But yeah. Well, I think in some there's some there has to be some integral which is conserved, I guess.
So you're shifting power from small scales to large scales.
Yeah, so. So we. So here's the definition of, just remember these two things. XE is basically, you know, what fraction do I initially ionize the universe? And ZE is when the first electrons start appearing. Okay, so these are the two. Basically, I'm trying to mock up the reionization history by these two parameters. You can obviously think of more complicated things to do. And here's what sort of different experiments can tell you. So x-axis is XE, and this is the redshift at which the first electrons start appearing. This one's for MAP, this one's for Planck, and this is some hypothetical super Planck. It's 25 times, just the raw sensitivity is 25 times Planck, which doesn't really tell you all that you need to know, but. Anyway, so what I've basically done here is taken, since we don't have data, you got to assume what the data looks like, and these stars here denote what I assume the true universe to be. So depending upon what the true universe is, you get different answers, right? So there's three different fiducial models that I consider.
But you keep the parameters fixed, and you don't account for any of the
So this is only looking at L less than 30. And out there, the only other parameter that actually, so this thing that I drew actually doesn't depend upon omega BH squared, doesn't depend upon omega matter H squared to 10%, simply because it's just like the Sachs-Wolfe effect. It's on really large scales. It's sourced by this delta, the quadrupole on large scale. So the only things it depends upon is A, amplitude, N, and tau. And if I just assume the prior for Planck, the N, then it doesn't really enter into this.
The normalization
is in there, yeah. So I've kept the A times e to the minus 2 tau fixed. because that's going to be measured like extraordinarily well.
So also, what we're trying to finally find out is the nature of the reionization, when it turns on, and
exactly.
What it wasn't.
Right.
I mean, that's the ultimate thing we'd like to learn from this.
Yeah.
But it won't be measured that well because anything will be suffering from the same general sound.
No, not from this. So A e to the minus 2 tau. So this quantity is just measured from the temperature part. It's got nothing to do with polarization. And that's going to be measured to like easily to like better than a percent.
Yes,
and
okay. So you take that combination.
Yeah, so I take this to be fixed. And then, you know, for the prior on the spectral index from Planck, it turns out that, you know, even if you put it in, it doesn't make any difference. So, sort of, and none of the other parameters actually affect this large angle stuff, simply because it's just like the Sachs-Wolfe effect. So it's actually a pretty simple calculation to do. Yeah, but that's, as I said, it's to 10%, none of these effects.
Yeah, but then those are constrained from, those you do constrain from beyond the
positive spectrum. To 10%, none of those things affect this calculation. I checked all of those things. So you're right. I mean, in general, there is this does depend upon omega lambda, omega matter A squared, and all those things. But the effect on this is like really tiny. Like a couple of percent or 2%, and you know, up to at L equals 30, the cosmic variance is like 10%. So, all these things, I mean, they just most of this is just really trying to beat the cosmic variance. Trying to get your detector to be almost as good as the cosmic variance. So the bottom panel is for MAP. This dotted line is just a constant optical depth of 0.06. So I've just chosen two models with the same optical depth of 0.06. And the contours here are, you can't see one is supposed to be thin and one is supposed to be thick. They're basically 10% and 1% of the maximum likelihood. So it's like 2 sigma and 3 sigma, something like that. So anyway, dashed is for this and solid is for that curve. And so from these two, what you should take out is MAP is not going to tell you a whole lot about when the first electrons came about, unless the optical depth is really large, like this is around 0.15. So with Planck, you see that this degeneracy is broken. It can actually distinguish between two models which have the same optical depth. So if this degeneracy was like complete, then you would expect, you know, the contour to run all along this and not be broken. But so you can actually get some information about when the first electrons came about. And of course,
sure. What are the outer contours? Is that
this is
two sigma?
Yeah. So I've basically done like 10% and 1% of the maximum likelihood. So that's 2 sigma and 3 sigma.
Even
Planck
at the sigma level overlap significantly with those two models.
Yeah, so you would have to be like, you know, somewhere here and there to. Yeah, so.
In the upper it's panel, you just assumed 25 times higher sensitivity, that's it.
That's it.
Now the same beam size, same everything
else. Yeah, same everything else. Yeah. Okay. So.
But you don't need beam size. This. You don't need small beams.
No, because it's on large angles.
Yeah.
I don't need small beams to do it. This game was just basically, you know, between L of like 20 and 10 and 30, you just need to, you know, get almost as good as cosmic variance, and that's this. This is really an experiment which is cosmic variance limited out to that. So, yeah. But of course, I mean, you've got to be pretty close to full sky to do these things. And the reason for actually, you know, and one of the reasons why you might want to look at these things is because if someday people are going to go behind B modes, then this is something that can be easily done with something like that. For example, the super Planck, which I said is like 25 times the sensitivity of Planck, would actually be able to look at B modes with tensor to scalar ratios greater than about 10 to the minus 3, which is, in terms of the energy scale of inflation, it's 5 times 10 to the 15 JeV. So super Planck is hypothetical, but if people are ever going to go behind B modes, this is sort of a side product. While in B modes, you don't really need to do all sky, but anyway.
Back to the fraction of sky that's unpolluted at the levels that we're talking about, a tiny fraction of sky.
How do you know that?
How do I know that? Well, based on all the models we have of galactic foregrounds and things that we expect, we don't have any reason to believe that it's 25 times the sensitivity of Planck. If you're talking about then sort of 40 nanokelvin?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, the sky is going to be heavily polluted at 40 nanokelvin. Maybe wrong, but there's some air flow out there.
Well, I mean, yeah, so.
But then you've looked up that.
Well, if you could get your foregrounds down to the 0.1% level, sure.
Yeah, so this entire game is based on assuming that the way the field has progressed until now will keep the same thing will happen like 10. Yeah, so, in the next 2 years, we might just learn that the foregrounds are just so bad that, we're not going to be able to do any of these things. Wow.
Well, no, the foregrounds at the level that we see in sort of many tens of microkelvin are reasonable. You're talking about getting several hundred times lower than tens of microkelvin.
Right.
And with everything we know, we're fairly confident that the foregrounds are going to be very, very significant at that kind of level of sensitivity. So you won't be able to be full sky in any sense of being able to be cosmic limiting over full sky. You'll have tiny patches of sky to be able to look through.
Yeah, which is, I think, pretty much useless because then you're shot down by a root of F sky. So maybe Planck is the best you can actually do. Anyway, what does this mean for the measurement of the optical depth? What I just need you to take from this plot is that it doesn't really affect the optical depth measurements of Planck that much. I mean, whatever they quoted their sensitivity to be would be the same. But so this is my model here at around 0.06. So one sigma is like 0.04 or 0.05. So, that's the message to take out of this is that MAP is not going to measure tau to better than 0.05. So, it might have already detected. This doesn't mean that it. So, this is different from asking whether MAP can detect the reionization signal or not. I mean, it can look here and say that, look, I just do a signal to, I just sum up all these things from n equals 2 to 30, and I ask, what is the signal to noise? That would still be greater than 1. It'll know that something is, that it has something here, but it may not be able to give you, it may not be able to tell you, right, tau is like 0.05 plus or minus 0.01. So I think it'll see something there. It probably will detect a reionization signature in 4 years, but it's going to be hard to actually give you any real quantitative measurements on tau. But it'll do better than what we know, because right now we only know that tau is less than 0.3. So it's still doing a factor of 3 better, at least. Anyway, actually, that's it.